From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, our agriculture series, Full Plate, continues with a conversation about Young Farmers MKE, a program that teaches kids about nutrition, ecology, and horticulture.
Later, new Lake Effect contributor Dave Beagle joins us to talk about Wisconsin's theater scene, including how and why to get people to go to their first show.
It's an unmatched experience, and theater wins people over for lifetimes once it gets a chance.
And we catch up with the mostly Milwaukee-based The Woolridge Brothers as they get ready to launch their newest album.
Over quite a few months, we continued to record and sort of refine and finesse the sound. This album definitely took us a while to do, but I think that worked to our advantage as far as really being able to get the sound we wanted and make the quality consistently high.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today we're continuing our summer agriculture series, Full Plate, with a look at a local program called Young Farmers MKE.
The program teaches kids about nutrition, ecology, and, you guessed it, farming practices. Students then sell the food they've grown at a weekly farm stand, which teaches kids how to manage a small business and helps develop their entrepreneurial skills.
And despite its name, founder Nick DeMarsh says Young Farmers MKE isn't meant to sell kids on the joys of farm life. Instead, they encourage participants to make goals and plans for the future. DeMarsh sat down with Lake Effect contributor Eden Herbert and explains why he started the program.
The Young Farmers program really is inspired by the young people I've been working with. And it came about because I was working with young people in gardens and they were some really amazing farmers. They could grow food. And I was like really impressed to see the way they took the lessons they learned and applied that. And the missing gap, though, was that they weren't necessarily interested in eating that food that they grew. And so what I found was that what inspired them, what seems to really engage them, was interest in selling that food. And sure enough, when we talked about selling it, you know, creating a farmer's market, they then started to ask about buying the food. And so I saw that, you know, in this world, which is just very commodified, in order for these young people to see an inherent value in the food that they're growing, they needed to see an economic value. So for me, that really involved what I think is really critical, which is listening to them and what it is that they value and what their perspective is. So seeing it through their eyes. And so I thought, well, if that's what's going to take, if that's what's important to them, let's sell this food. And it allowed us to create that process of them seeing a value in it and having pride in what they're growing. And what's resulted is not only them wanting to take that food home, sharing it with their family, but something that I didn't quite see, though perhaps I hoped, is that it became a really great tool for community engagement. So the young people are selling the food to their neighbors, and then their neighbors get to know these young people. It creates intergenerational connections. It also kind of helps to, I think, erode a little bit of the stereotype that can happen when you have large gaps between generations. Young people and old people maybe see each other through different perspectives, so they start to be able to relate better. And the older people, especially the people living in the senior home across the street from our Metcalf Park Young Farmers Program, they get to see the young farmers working when they're sitting outside, or they can see the young farmers from their building. And it's just a fun thing for them to see the young people working in their garden. They ask about the young people. So it's a great community engagement piece, just creating neighborhood commerce.
What are the ages of the kids that are involved with Young Farmers?
It's really a late elementary school and middle school program at our Metcalf Park site. And we've also have a high school component, which is the advanced program, where they actually have been growing for CSA customers and for restaurants. And so that's kind of our next tier.
Oh, that's awesome. So are you hoping that the kids that are involved in the program eventually go on to become farmers?
Yeah, it's a really good question. My hope is that this program serves to open doors for the young people. So we've incorporated bike delivery in our programs. So we've partnered with the Bike Federation. So our young farmers got to learn bike safety. We've incorporated a lot of elements like that that really use the young farming component as the kind of centerpiece of the program, the entrepreneurship as a centerpiece of the program. Also, literacy is a really key part of the program to keep the kids reading during the summertime, which is a lot of studies indicate that it's so important that kids continue to read throughout the summer. So we're using the urban agriculture and entrepreneurship as the centerpiece, but using that as a kind of a hub, if you will, to spoke out into different avenues for engagement. And so my hope is really that this serves as a platform for the young people to find out what it is that's really important to them. So if gardening is really important to them and in the future they want to have a backyard garden, if they want to be like me and have a small urban farm, then great. But that's not really my goal. My goal is just to help them find what their goals are. And along the way, of course, doing things like summertime literacy education helps to ensure that those doors of opportunity remain open to them. And that's also really important to me, is just to keep those doors open.
So if it's not necessarily about agriculture, I'm wondering if you think that it's farming as the specific thing that leads to those doors, or if there's another way that you could have gone about this.
Yeah, honestly, it was inspired when I was working with these young people. And like I said, they were great at farming. If they were great at baseball or if they were great at something else, I would have been happy to go down that road. But I saw both their and the talent, the skills that they developed during the time I was working with them, and the opportunity insofar as urban agriculture is obviously a big topic here. It's something that I felt like they could generate revenue. So we started the program off, myself and eight other like inspired young people. And I went out and sought out CSA members to support the program. And so it was that built-in skill set from them and the interest from the community. And I felt like, you know, the community would stand up and support the young people that I was working with because I cared and because they cared. But what I did think about, and really the story that that I tell that matters a lot to me, is that one young man that I was working with, I asked him, what do you want to be when you grow up? And he said, I want to be a business owner. And so I said, oh, that's interesting. He knows what he wants. So I said, well, what kind of business? And he said, I don't know. And so that struck me that he was so certain he wanted to be a business owner, but didn't know even what business he wanted to own. So then I asked him, why? Why do you want to be a business owner? And he said, well, I want to be my own boss. And so that for me was really what clicked. And I said, oh, so if you want to be your own boss, you already could start a farm business tomorrow. Could he necessarily open up another business? A lot of businesses take a lot of capital investment. Farming typically does, but the way we do it with a 4x8 box, really good soil, which is the most expensive, and of course labor, which is just kind of sweat equity, that's something that was right in front of him and the other young people that I was working with. So certainly entrepreneurship, I think, is what they can learn from this opportunity. They can apply that if they want to start their own business or work in the business sector. But of course, the nature of the world today, those skills apply pretty much anywhere. So yeah, farming, I think, is a great backbone for life skills. And I guess another thing I'd throw out there is that it requires patience. And so this day and age, obviously, things are so instant. It's a really amazing skill to develop, just to be able to put a seed in the ground, make sure that that plant grows to be healthy, learn when things don't quite work out. And that's my role, is to help them along the way. But when things do work out a couple months later, or really a couple years later, because it's a multi-year process, then you're seeing over time, wow, if I really dedicate myself to this, I can see the progress. I can see these plants grow and be healthy. I can have people from the neighborhood compliment me, eat the food that I'm growing. I can take this food home and my parents can make a great meal. I can help my parents, which is another thing we do. We have nutrition and cooking education. So I can experience the delicious taste of the hard work that I've done, and I get to help other people in my community do that. And so that's, you know, it does a lot. It's a source of pride for the kids. It's an opportunity to have some positive transformation in the community. But like I said, it's a lot more than farming.
So I'm wondering, when you started, you said that you were already working in farming with young kids before this fully developed into young farmers. And I'm wondering if, as you looked around the community, you noticed that there was a specific need for what ultimately became young farmers.
Sure. Yeah. So, like I said, I was inspired by the vision of the young people I was working with. And I also didn't quite see something happening like this in the community. Wondered if it was possible. I didn't really know at the time. But actually, I went on a trip to Detroit. I was already planning to visit there. I had a friend who moved there, a woman named Grace Lee Boggs, who's a visionary activist and scholar who's been based in Detroit. She really recently passed away at 100 years old. She was helping to lead a conference at the time, and I was able to learn at that conference and experience some of the programs going on in Detroit. And Detroit was really an affirming experience for me because I saw kind of a kindred city to us, one that also has a lot of challenges but is addressing those challenges in a lot of ways, including agriculture. And I saw Detroit kind of approaching it from a slightly different way, which was more of a smaller individual plots, engaged in kind of the way I was thinking about starting the Young Farmers Program. And so that was affirming to me. Kind of the vision of Grace Lee Boggs is definitely a philosophical guide for the way that I approach my work. And then a couple people here who have been applying, I think, her philosophy, Venus Williams and Jan Christensen, are people who I've been working with, especially Jan. She and I developed the program together. So using some of the inspiration from the young people and seeing other people doing this in Detroit and people carrying on that spirit here in Milwaukee to do this work has definitely been an inspiration for me.
If this didn't exist, what do you think would be lacking for your participants in Young Farmers?
Without this program, I think they would be doing something good. I think the young people that I work with are pretty remarkable people, and I think they would take the opportunities in front of them. I think that's just the challenge in the city is that there's just not enough opportunities. So it's hard for me to say for sure. It varies on the person. What I don't think would necessarily happen is the connections between people, between community. I think too often, as we all know, it's a very segregated city. And I think fragmentation is writ large across the city. It's kind of a symptom of a broader kind of just disconnect that we have between each other. And I think there's some great, I love the city, I think there's some great things, but I think that's one of the best platforms of this program is connections across the entire city and within neighborhoods.
And you said the whole thing originated from you farming with these young kids. What is your background in agriculture?
Yeah, my background is that I learned a little bit about the value of urban agriculture from the kind of an environmental perspective when I was in school, like at University of Oregon, they had an urban farm on campus, and that seemed good, but it didn't really quite resonate with me until I started volunteering at Growing Power and really saw the kind of social and political, and so far as addressing these barriers. So volunteering there and seeing an opportunity to connect with people from across this very segregated city seemed like a powerful thing. And so worked there with Will Allen, met Karen Parker, who has been a huge part of that organization. And she helped to kind of say, yeah, you should come out and get involved, and worked there for years. And so that's been a big part of what got me into this. I wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't for Growing Power.
And I also want to talk about the other opportunities you're involved with under the overall Groundwork Milwaukee.
Yeah.
There's Farmers Union, which helps address barriers for local, urban, and peri-urban farmers to sell their products in the area, which to me sounds like a good complement to Young Farmers MKE. Do you see a relationship growing between the two?
Yeah, so Milwaukee Farmers Union is a group of people who you know, you could say we graduated out of Growing Power. So we took our skills and we started our own small farms. And there's a number of people who are interested in urban farming and see those, you know, small barriers that they want to address. And so, you know, that ranges from infrastructure to access to customers, all the small pieces that we need to put into place to make this happen for people who want to make a go at it to be for profit. And of course, that is a potential continuation for young people I work with Young Farmers Program and other people, young people learning about urban ag in Milwaukee, is that just like myself on my small farm, I need some of those barriers addressed. And so if young people do want to come out of the Young Farmers Program and actually try to have this as a side business or a career, they're going to need that support. And so, yeah, Groundwork has been really great to be able to create this kind of stepping stone for people to progress, and the Farmers Union can help to create that capacity for people to be able to get food into the community more easily in a kind of a seamless path right to people's plate.
So Milwaukee gets really cold, and I imagine that agriculture doesn't flourish so much in those months. So what are you doing when Milwaukee is in those times when things aren't growing as well?
Yeah. So a big part of our Young Farmers Program is that we're doing nutrition education and cooking classes with the young people in the wintertime. So that's been a great thing. We've partnered with UWM's Nutrition Science Program, and that's one fantastic way we can continue it. In discussion with some folks at MPS about doing some programming at schools. So yeah, there's always something to do.
Nick DeMarsh is the founder of Young Farmers MKE, and he spoke with Lake Effect contributor Eden Herbert. For more information about the program, check out WUWM.com.
A short break now, and then we begin a series of regular conversations with Milwaukee theater critic Dave Beagle. Stay tuned for that when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Everything about it is appealing. Everything that traffic will allow.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today we're starting a series of conversations with Milwaukee theater critic Dave Beagle. Beagle is a longtime lover and reviewer of Wisconsin theater. When the season is in full swing, he will often see four or five shows in a three-day period. It's his job, but it's also his passion.
Lake Effect will continue to profile and talk to theater artists as we've always done, but I also welcome the opportunity to talk about theater at large, as it were, with someone who shares my enthusiasm for the art form and who gets to see a lot more of it than I can. We also envision this as a way of introducing you to some companies and performances you might not otherwise hear about. And as Beagle reminds us, that's important because most theater companies operate on a fine financial line.
They're all struggling with many of the same issues. Their audiences, in some cases, are getting older. They're like my age. They're trying to figure out how to get younger people to come to the theater. And I think that the more you talk about it, the more you talk about it, you and I talk about it, maybe something people will hear something that catches their attention, and they'll go see a play. And I've often said that if you go once, you're probably going to go the rest of your life because it's an unmatched experience. It's not the same as going to a movie or binge watching on television. It's an unmatched experience, and theater wins people over for lifetimes once it gets a chance.
So it's the trick of getting people in the door that first time.
I think that's it. I think everybody's struggling with that. From the rep to the newest, smallest company in town, they all wonder, how can I get people to come to the theater? You know, doing theater is a labor of love for almost everybody. I mean, you don't make a lot of money doing theater. So it's a labor of love, and you'd like to see that love rewarded by people coming and appreciating it.
Well, and I was going to say, even Broadway, where people think there's big, and there's big money in Broadway, but people aren't making a lot of money usually, even on Broadway.
Well, the stars. If you're a star, if you're a Josh Groban doing a play on Broadway, you make a lot of money. But if you're just an average equity actor, depending on the size of the house, I mean, you could be working for, you know, $800, $900 a week. And, you know, very few people work every week during a year. So they may be making $40,000 a year, somewhere around there. And living in New York on $40,000 a year is at best a challenge.
I was going to say, with your five roommates in a studio
apartment.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult situation.
So you come out here, places like Wisconsin. I mean, one of the things that has changed, certainly in the time that I've been paying attention to theater, is the whole regional theater concept has shifted. There, that used to be a way for people to make a living outside of New York, a good living.
Yeah.
You could make a nice middle-class wage as an actor, as a director, as a scenic person, whatever you were doing. But that seems to have gone by the wayside, too.
I was thinking on my way in here today, how many actors or theater professionals do I know in Milwaukee who make their living doing it, and don't have some other job? I'm telling you, once I get past one hand, I have a hard time getting to six, seven, and eight. And I mean that. There are very few people who take an actor like Norman Moses, who is as talented, as experienced, as wonderful a person on the stage as you could possibly imagine in any city of the United States. You know, Norman works as a tour guide at Lakefront Brewery because he can't, make enough money to support himself and his family on just acting. You know, that's a tough situation.
What about APT, though? I mean, I know that's only the summer, and we're going to talk about some of the shows that you've seen there, but what role does APT play in the theater landscape?
Well, APT is an aberration in the state of Wisconsin. APT is arguably one of the top classical theater companies in the world. Terry Teachout, who's the critic for the Wall Street Journal and probably the number two or three critic in the world, said that APT is the best outdoor classical theater company in the world, the entire world. So they have a slightly different structure. You know, they have a core company. They have a lot of subscribers. I mean, Madison is a city where they just turn out in droves. They have two theaters. They have the big Up the Hill Theater, which seats about 1,000, and the smaller Touchstone Theater, which is just over 200, I think. They are sold out almost every performance. Now, they're able then to pay a pretty good wage, and they get the best people around. I mean, when they open up auditions for APT's plays during the summer, once you get past the core company, all of those people who live in Spring Green and around there, there's a flood of actors from all over the world who want to work there. So they're slightly different. The rep is, at the same level as far as performance goes, I think. But most of the rep actors, I would say, come from out of town. The rep is not focused on Milwaukee or Wisconsin actors. Now, the rep uses a lot of people from Wisconsin and Milwaukee, but that's not their focus, I don't think.
And that's changed.
That has changed.
Yeah.
That has changed.
There used to be a core company. When I first got here, there was that rep company. Yeah.
There was. And one of the things that Mark Clements did when he came in, Joe Hanratty had his core company. Mark Clements decided he wanted to broaden the talent pool while still having reverence for the local actors and the people who are in that company. So we'll see Jim Pickering and Deborah Staples and people like that who still do things at the rep, but the rep casts a much wider net. And, it's a decision you make.
Right.
And they made this decision, and they're very successful with it. I mean, the rep is on very solid financial footing.
How about some of the smaller theaters? I mean, they're the always, as you say, they're the ones that are kind of on the precipice. I think we have such riches here in Milwaukee in terms of the theater landscape. I don't think I've ever been anywhere of this size where there was so much good theater to choose from.
I think that's true. I think, first of all, I don't think of theater as a competitive sport. I don't think that Next Act is competing against Renaissance and which play is better. I just don't view theater that way. I view each performance kind of in its own little vacuum. But we do have a lot of high-level theater in Milwaukee, where you can expect if you go to a production by one of those companies, by a Next Act, by a Chamber Theater, by a Renaissance Theater, in tandem. Those kinds of groups, you are always going to get a show with good, solid production values. Now, your enjoyment of the show and the execution by the actors and maybe the play is bad, stuff like that. But at least you know that the production values are going to be high level and they're going to reach for the stars. And most of the times, they're going to grab the stars. They'll land there.
And I find that wonderful because usually it's an embarrassment of riches in terms of a weekend if I'm looking at what to do on a Saturday night. I'm not even counting music and other things to do, in theater. When the seasons are in full swing, it's like there's no way I can see everything.
I was looking at the schedule, trying to figure out when you and I are going to get together. There are a whole bunch of weekends that I'm seeing a Thursday night, a Friday night, and a two on Saturday, a matinee and an evening. Now, that's four plays in,
72 hours.
Something like that. You know, that's a lot of theater.
Yeah.
That's a lot of theater. But, you know, it's a good thing. You know, I have to go because that's what I do. But it also presents difficult choices for the theater-going audience. You know, as you say, what are you going to go see? You know, you have to make a choice because, first of all, it's not a real cheap entertainment. You know, I don't think you could describe theater in Milwaukee as an inexpensive date. But they're tough choices, you know. But whatever choice you make, you're probably going to do okay. I think the one thing that Milwaukee is missing in the theater landscape is younger, edgier, more experimental theater companies, much like the long-gone, lamented Youngblood Theater was.
I was just thinking of them, yeah.
The same thing when Jim Farrell and Niffer Clark ran Splinter Group. You know, now they weren't big productions. The sets were often spare, but they took on some things that you wouldn't see normally in Milwaukee. You know, I think Milwaukee is missing those for a couple of reasons. Number one, the plays, but number two, opportunities for young actors, young directors, young designers to get some work. If I were to fault Milwaukee Theater for anything, and it's probably an unavoidable fault. Pretty much the same actors continue to work in Milwaukee. People who are tried and true and proven. And if I'm producing a play, I can say, yeah, that's the kind of people I want. I don't want to take a chance on somebody where there's a bomb. You know, if I have a bad play, a bad attended play, my whole year is ruined. You know, and that bothers people a lot, I think. You know, so they're very cautious about giving shots for new actors. There's a lot of actors in Milwaukee who leave Milwaukee. And I think that if we could have a few more young, aggressive, bold companies, you could get some work for these actors, and they're going to grow up to be the people who are going to be the next act, and they're going to be the Renaissance, you know.
Well, I was just going to say Michael Cody, who started Youngblood, is back this season to direct at
Chamber. He's directing Death Trap, which is Chamber is annually the first play in the Milwaukee theater season, and they're doing it again this year. It's August something, 10th, 11th, somewhere around there, when they're doing Death Trap, and that kind of kicks off the season. But Michael's a perfect example. You know, Michael went from here, where he was both acting and directing a little, but he really wants to direct, so he went down to Northwestern and, you know, studied there, and now he's coming back here to direct. That's what he wants to do. And he's not going to stick around. I mean, there's a number of people, who I wish would had stayed here, and they haven't.
Right, you know. Because the opportunities aren't there to be able to make a living outside of being a waiter.
Oh, yeah. You don't even get a chance to, if you're a young actor, a lot of times you don't get a chance to do anything. Forget making a living. Try just being in a production with a Jim Pickering or, you know, with a Laura Gordon or something like that. The educational value for a young actor is unparalleled, being able to do those kinds of things. And it doesn't happen for them in Milwaukee. Young actors get together and they do plays with other young actors, and they're not really learning anything by doing it. You know, it's just they're doing what they do.
We have just a few minutes to kind of talk about some of the things you've seen. APT, quickly, everything looks amazing. Flea in Her Ear happens to be one of my favorite plays.
Well, let me tell you, APT has five of its eight plays in repertory now. and you can't go wrong with any of them. But if somebody said to me, which play should I go see at APT, I got a tie for first place. One is Unexpected Man, which is this kind of unknown play by Yasmin Reza, which has Brian Manny and Sarah Day as Brian is an author, Sarah Day is a reader of his books. They get stuck together in the berth of a train, and they never, throughout 75 minutes of play, talk to each other. It is only each individual's musing, alternating one after the other. Laura Gordon directed it. I've seen the play twice before, and I was vastly unimpressed in other places I saw it. She has found a humanity in this play that's unbelievable. I mean, it's an incredible experience. And the other one is A Flea in Her Ear. I mean, it is a farce that is as farcical and as funny, I think, as any play I've seen in the last 10 years. I mean, literally, 1,000 people laughed throughout the play. David Frank, who directed it, did something very interesting in the play. There are a number of comedic lines in the play that are just throwaways. They throw them away, and you can tell they're doing it. And on one hand, you'd say, boy, they're really missing those. But on the other hand, he's giving the audience time to catch its breath. I mean, because honest to God, my wife was with me. She was worn out from laughing. I said, do you want to go have dinner? She said, no, I want to go home and go to bed. You know,
I'm tired.
It's that funny. I mean, it's that kind of physical
Well,
fun.
Phaedo, I mean, the Flea in Her Ear to me is sort of the grandfather of all farces.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
It is the one that all other farces aspire to be. And, you know, that wonderful description of what is a farce, you know, it's a comedy with more than four doors.
Right, exactly.
And,
exactly.
And so here it is. And this is the one that I'm aiming for,
well,
I have to say.
Go see it because you start laughing and you don't stop till the play's over. So go see it, Bonnie.
All right. I plan to.
Yeah.
Dave Beagle, it has been such a pleasure having you in. I'm looking forward to more conversations. Next time we'll get into some more plays,
okay.
But I wanted to kind of get us set up this
time. Well, I'm glad we got set up. People who want to read the full reviews, you know, they can go to DaveBeagleOnTheater.com.
We're going
to
link directly
link
to yours.
Link all of this stuff.
Yep.
You know, people can come here, people can go there, and
go to the theater.
Most important, go to the theater, absolutely. Thanks, Bonnie. I'm looking forward to this.
Lake Effect contributor Dave Beagle writes about theater at his website, DaveBeagleOnTheater.com. There's a link to all of his reviews on our website, WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break and then talk with the Woolridge Brothers about their new album, which will officially launch next week at Anodyne Coffee in Walker's Point. That's coming up next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Let's go on with the show.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. The Woolridge Brothers, Scott and Brian, have been a band for quite a few years now. They're mostly based in Milwaukee. Scott moved to Minneapolis a few years ago. And the band showcased at South by Southwest in the late 90s. Since then, they've had songs placed in films such as Contact and Some Mother's Son, and on TV shows like Party of Five.
And the band has kept going, touring and putting out albums pretty regularly. Even as Scott has pursued a solo career in Minneapolis and Brian has gone out on tour in support of other acts. Next week, they'll introduce their newest album, Starts at Dusk, at a launch party at Anodyne Coffee in Walker's Point.
But I'm not a man on a mission anymore. I'm just a man in between.
We invited the brothers and Anodyne owner Matt McClutchie into the studio to talk about the new album. Brian, who joined us by phone from Minneapolis, explained how Starts at Dusk came to be.
We
started working on this album quite a while ago. We actually did some of the early recording in Minneapolis, where I live. Brian's based in Milwaukee, and various other band members are sort of around that area. So we were recording in Minneapolis. We did some up there, and then we did a Kickstarter project, which incorporated both a solo album that I was finishing up and the early phases of this album. And then over quite a few months, we continued to record and sort of refine and finesse the sound. This album definitely took us a while to do, but I think that worked to our advantage as far as really being able to get the sound we wanted and make the quality consistently high.
One of the things I love about the sound of this is I hear Beach Boys influence. I hear Eagles. It's very lush, you know, the arrangements. Yet it just really rocks, too. Where do you guys feel it fits into sort of your whole catalog?
Well, Scott and I are originally from Indiana, and we grew up through that time of Tom Petty and the Eagles and stuff. So I don't think we can help but have that in our musical output.
I got to say, the Eagles comparison, we've heard it a couple times, and it does kill me a little bit.
In a good way or a bad way?
not in such a good way. I'm sorry.
But whatever you say about the Eagles, they really knew how to arrange.
They did. Yeah. They were amazing vocalists.
Yes, they were.
Yeah. And, but we did listen to them. And you know, I heard their songs growing up. I had their albums. So, yeah, we were definitely influenced by classic rock, no doubt about it.
Well, this might date me a little bit, but I think when I got my first 8-track, when I was 7th grade or whatever, you know? The tape that came along with it was The Greatest Hits by the Eagles.
So, there you go.
Yeah. So.
But what I love about it is that I hear those echoes in there, but you've made it yours.
Yeah. Well, like I said, coming from Indiana, I think all that stuff is in our musical spirit, or whatever you want to call it, and it comes out in that way. And we weren't trying to make a theme album, but as we did the video out at Highway 18 Outdoor Theater for Drive Through Summer, we shot a video. It was at an old drive-in theater, and it was just the vibe of that scene and hanging out there, I think, kind of shaped the vibe of the album, and that's why we came up with Starts at Dusk, and we thought the songs fit in that, and we were kind of going for, you know, a retro sound, but that's just maybe just the way our influences play out.
That was a summer she worked a drive through at McDonald's, and I put on 15 pounds. Yeah, she must have earned commission. She told me she'd get bored if I stopped coming around. Well, that polyester uniform, she made it look exotic. When she said the word supersize, it was almost erotic. Well,
and, you know, from the writer's perspective, Brian and I collaborated quite a bit on this album, and he wrote one of the songs, and so it wasn't just me, but we're really influenced by a lot of stuff, and not just classic rock. I mean, I know that my influences include Robin Hitchcock and Elvis Costello and Squeeze and
exactly,
stuff like that. So, I mean, it's still very kind of dated, I guess, but that generation of music had a huge impact on us. I mean, some of the damage to me is very Big Star-ish, which I guess they're classic rock.
Well, they are now.
Era, yeah, they're from that era, but they were really looked up to by a lot of the sort of new wave and alternative bands that were big when we were really, really discovering our favorite types of music.
Have to live,
myself it was just some of the damage. I wish I could walk again to your door, to your door, and make everything all right, but that chance won't come no more. All we see, all we can ever see is just some of the damage. Never free, even healed, we carry some of the damage. All right.
In the writing process now, and as the band has evolved and as your musical careers have evolved, do you find yourself moving away from that, or just trying to incorporate all that stuff, or not even really thinking about it at all?
Well, just like one song Scott and I were working on together, Blade Number 1 and 2, and has something to do with the movies from whatever the 90s. We, you know, I had an idea of doing kind of a Kinks sounding song, and
yeah.
And so Scott and I were talking about that, and then the chorus is more of an Elvis Costello pump it up type thing, and so that's just how it comes out, right? And, you know, we don't sit there and go, oh, let's write the, you know, Velvet Underground song, or let's write, you know. It just, when you're playing something, sometimes you think, oh, it kind of, you know, it pulls a memory of some other song.
Right.
And but you don't try to shape it.
The writing process, you're not really thinking about it. But you do hear it once you start, you know, once you've written it and mm-hmm. go back to, as Brian said, it's kind of filling out the sound.
Mm-hmm. Right, and nothing is in a vacuum. We're right. all influenced by everything we've ever heard and read and
right.
seen.
Right,
you know?
Right, right.
Yeah.
So a lot of people compare us to, or at least our, I mean, I think this album is kind of a departure for us. We were more Americana, maybe roots rock, some people called us before. And not that it's a drastic change, but it is, to me, a little bit more of a change. And this was due to, you know, more of a band, cohesive band.
Right. I would say it's a little more, and I don't mean this in a bad way, a little more produced. Mm-hmm. I tend to think of Americana as just grittier. Mm-hmm. You know, that tends mm-hmm. to be kind of like, yeah, a couple,
raw.
You know, raw.
Right. Right.
And this has elements of that, but
it's more.
It's smoother. And,
yeah.
And more, yeah, there's more layers
right.
going on.
Scott Gorsuch had a huge role in that. I mean, he really had some ideas that he, I mean, when we were on tour, was it last summer? Or,
yeah,
last summer with the Baseball Project, we were talking about, you know, how we wanted the album to progress and what we wanted it to sound like. And Scott just, we were in the van and Scott was playing me all these different acts and saying, you know, we could try this or we could try that. And we really did rely on his expertise, and he's got a huge knowledge of music. And so he was able to really add some interesting sounds and sort of consistently throughout the album sort of make those influences or those sounds work for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Scott Gorsuch and myself really clicked on shaping the album production and arrangement-wise. We are heavily influenced by the same artist. We go see the same bands. We like the same players. Justin Curry from Delamitri, you know, John Vanderslice and all those different people. So, you know, we were talking about these things as they came up. So he wrote like string arrangements. So Place in the Sun, I think
yep.
you were talking about. That song is actually an older song, probably the oldest song maybe yep. on the album.
Yes, definitely.
That my brother Scott wrote on keyboards. It was a slower song, melancholy kind of song. And
mm-hmm.
I've always liked the song, and it's just kind of been sitting in the, you know, closet for a while. I pulled it out for this album and stripped away his music, and I wrote a bass part that was more upbeat, more in the Beatle-esque world, and we built it from there, and, you know, and then we just kind of rearranged it, and G added the strings,
and
now it's more of an XTC, you know, type poppy song.
And that was one of the first ones we recorded, and again, mm-hmm. it was sort of, very much a band collaboration, because we all kind of try to figure out what we could bring to the table and what would work. And, you know, Brian and I, our last album, Days Went Around, it was just basically me and him in the studio. Mm-hmm. We had Dave Braun, is that it?
Yep.
The drummer?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And but that was it. And we hadn't really rehearsed the songs, and we just kind of went in the studio and recorded them. We were very happy with how Days Went Around turned out.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, there were some songs that were really poppy and some songs that were really more country. And then, you know, it was just kind of back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I just think the consistency of the sound of the new album is one of the things that really makes it work.
Well, Matt, I want to bring you in now, because part of what's happening with this new album is you are doing this at Anodyne. You're doing the release.
Yeah.
That's right.
We've been working with Matt for a couple of years now for shows, and I've been pushing some other bands that I know through the Midwest to his place, and we really love what he's doing there and his respective artists, and, of course, his coffee.
Yeah. Yes, I have to say, I am not a coffee drinker, but I'm a tea drinker, and I always get great tea at Anodyne.
Yeah, so
plug. I'll accept that. You're
yeah,
welcome.
Yeah,
you're welcome.
To come. Yeah. Yeah. So, Matt, what got you started in basically being a concert promoter in some senses, as well as a coffee person?
A little bit by accident. You know, when we opened the Walker's Point facility in 2014, the building was just set up perfect as a music venue with a stage. It just kind of lended itself perfectly to special events. We do wedding receptions, you know, fundraiser events, things like that. And music, I've been going to shows, you know, since I can remember, and followed the local music scene a little bit. So it just sort of developed slowly.
And well, it seems like it's a place now, it's on the map, from what I can tell, as a place to go hear bands.
I totally agree.
You know, you know, you hear the rave, you hear this, you hear that, mm-hmm. but you also hear Anodyne and Walker's Point.
Right.
And I think that's just such a cool mix of things.
I've been really lucky to get really nice support from a lot of local musicians, such as Brian, you know, who have helped out a lot. You know, I don't have any experience in it. Just sort of started, friends of friends, sure, come and play. We'll give it a shot. And it slowly developed from there.
So is this something you see expanding? Is this something you want to do more of?
I'm enjoying it a lot, yeah. It's a coffee roasting facility, so that kind of comes first. You know, we roast coffee first, second shift, at least 5 days a week. So that's kind of got to come first. That's the business side of things. But the music, you know, anytime I can plug it in there, it's been great and a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So, Brian and Scott, for you guys, what is it like playing in that kind of venue versus, say, a more traditional bar or even a concert hall, for that matter?
Well, I went to Matt with the idea of partnering up and only releasing the album at his stores. And because, you know, we all know with the digital revolution that, you know, record stores are challenged and a lot of them have gone away. And so the distribution of a physical CD or album is different these days than it was. And I was trying to think outside of the box and do something a little different than just, you know, having it an exclusive, which is a great place. But I was just trying to push people. And also, I'm a big supporter of local entrepreneurs. And so I thought of him, and I went down and talked to him. I work a couple blocks away.
So that was tough. to get over there.
Yeah, it was tough to go over there and buy some coffee.
I could see that.
And so we sat down, and I said, hey, would you want to sell this at the stores? And he said, sure.
The actual official release party
is August 4th, Friday, August 4th at Anodyne. And the Fainting Room will be opening for us.
The Fainting Room is not part of the facility. It's the band.
Yeah, it's another band.
It's not the room.
Yeah, it's not an actual room. But they're real good, and we're looking forward to working with them.
Well, and that's one of the things that is interesting, too, because you guys have been doing this a while, and now you are in the position of helping up-and-coming bands, where you were once in that position, you know, of touring with, you know, supporting other people. How does it feel to be on the other side of that?
Feels good. I mean, I'm always trying to help, you know, anybody who I like and I want to help promote their band or their name.
I live in Minneapolis and perform under my own name, so I'm still one of the little people up here.
You're still, like, in support of.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do my own shows, but the Wooldridge Brothers definitely have a bigger footprint. I don't know if that's the greatest term to use, but people know us in Milwaukee. And in Minneapolis, there's so many bands and so many acts. It's hard to make a lot of headway, but there's a great scene here, and I enjoy working here. It's a little different situation.
You guys planning to tour this album?
Well, we were lucky enough to go on tour last summer with the Baseball Project, and then before that, we were lucky enough to be invited to play at First Avenue in Minneapolis, and we did part of it's called the Big Star 3 show, which had a lot of people in it from REM. And
Big Star's third.
Third, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's like a sold-out show, and so that helped us a lot out in Minneapolis.
So I know you've got day jobs, and so it's hard to...
Yeah.
jobs and families and, you know,
we do hope to promote it. We won't probably be touring this year, but maybe next summer.
And maybe Summerfest again.
I hope, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be great.
Because
I'd love to hear this stuff live.
Well, if you're around on the 4th, come on down.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. Best of luck with the album. And Matt, best of luck with the business.
Thank
you. More live music is all I can say. More the better.
Sounds great.
Sounds great to me. Thanks.
Scott Wooldridge joined us by phone from his home in Minneapolis. Brian Wooldridge and Anodyne Coffee owner Matt McClutchy were in the studio.
The Wooldridge Brothers' new album, Starts at Dusk, will have its CD release party at the Anodyne in Walker's Point on Friday, August 4th. There is more information at WUWM.com. And that wraps up the Thursday edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today. And please be with us tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.